Before we begin, let's take a few moments to realize how lucky we are. To be able to hear the teachings of the Buddha. To be living a life that is blessed with Dhamma and in the environment of the Mahasangha. So let's take a few moments to venerate the Supreme One, the Sublime One, the incomparable One, the One who spent many eons searching for the truth in the many, many eons in samsara, the Tathagata. Let's take a few moments to worship the Supreme Buddha by chanting the Namaskara all together and with me.
Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas.
What is the one thing in this world you cannot live without? What is the one thing in this world you cannot live without? Now, in your minds, there are probably hundreds of answers. Different people will have different answers. Some of you will be thinking, well, I can't live without food. Food is so important to me. Some of you will be thinking, well, I can't live without my family. My family is the most important thing to me. Some of you will be thinking, I can't live without, I don't know, my job. My job means everything to me. Now, each one of us, each unique, each with a different mind that arises differently, will have a different thing to say. However, what makes us all unique also is what makes us the same. What is the most important thing to you in this life? Is your ability to be happy. Nothing more. And according to that, that fundamental thing, other things are built upon it. So your job, food, and for most of us, being surrounded by the Mahasangha, being submerged in the sublime teachings of the Dhamma. That is what's most valuable, the ability to be happy. The ability to make choices that brings us closer to happiness. Because that's something that is unique to humans. Although, you know, animals also have the ability to think. Animals also have the ability to, you know, search for happiness. The one thing they cannot do is make choices. Make choices with intelligence. As we all know, the human beings are one of the most intelligent species on the planet. So far, they're the only species that can, you know, invent, speak, and do all these magical things. However, what also sets us apart is our ability to think, our ability to make choices, our ability to use our intelligence to take another step forward, to be more happy. A tiger will never think, or a lion will never think, today, you know, is it good to kill an antelope? A tiger or lion will never think, should I not hunt today? Instead, the moment it feels the urge, you know, the same urge that we have, this rumbling in our stomach, it thinks, who's my next target? And the antelope? The antelope will never think, how can I share the grass that I found with others? Instead, how am I going to eat as much as I possibly can? How am I going to store as much as I possibly can? How can I keep everything I have? See, this is what sets us apart from animals. We have the ability to use our intelligence to make choices, to make this idea that, you know, to change the way we behave, using our views to change the way that we behave. You know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Actually, not just dogs. You see, we all have the ability to change. That is what makes us fundamentally humans. There is no human on this planet that says, I cannot change. Although they may think and believe it, it does not work like that. We all have the ability to change. So if you're someone who knows that you have these sort of traits, trust me, you can change. If you say that, you know, how can I ever, you know, live without drinking coffee in the morning? Trust me, you can change. How can I, you know, for my entire life, I was addicted to my phone. How can I change? Well, trust me, you can change. That's what makes us human. Because it's not about being human or not. It's never about being human or not. It's about the views that we hold. As humans, or let's bring it down one bit further and say, you know, as a mind with this quality of humans, it has a door that's open. The door that we're able to accept views. For example, you know, an animal doesn't have a set of views that it follows by. You cannot give a view to an animal. Instead, they work with the views they have. And they build small, small views, but not the same views that we can build. Not the same ones that we can ever build. They can only have these very small views. So, for example, if you want to teach a dog how to catch, you cannot explain to the dog that catching is good. Instead, you can explain, if you catch, I give food. Food gives you happiness. So what should you do? Catch. But for us, do we do the same thing? You know, for you to do something, do I need to show you that you have to, you know, you get food, you get this, you get that? No, all you have to say is, you know, this is a very good thing to do. This is what makes us separate from animals. We're able to take in views. We're able to take new views and act upon it. That's why animals can't attain nibbana, but humans can. What's the difference? Animals cannot take the view of Dhamma, but humans we can. That's what makes us very special. That's what makes us extremely special. We have the ability to understand the truth. We have the ability to, you know, take one step forwards in understanding the truth and continue to do that. But animals? They can't. Whether you believe in rebirth or not, regardless, This is not about rebirth here. This is about the being of a human and the being of an animal. That makes us, and that's why human life is the most valuable. Human life is the most valuable. You know, I remember a couple maybe years back, one of my teachers, the way they explained human life, how valuable human life is. Now, he asked me, have you ever, you know, scratched a card for lottery tickets? Right, you know, lotteries. Yeah. Have you ever done it? And I said, no, I haven't. But, you know, my father has. How many times has he won the lottery? Like, you know, the big prize, the $1 million. And I remember telling him, you know, I wish he did. Because then he could drop everything here and drop everything there and come here. And so he said, imagine a person was to, you know, buy a lottery ticket every day and win first place. So the $1 million every day. That is equivalent, or that is not yet as, that's not still as equivalent as the value of a human life. It's like winning a lottery ticket every day. So imagine living a long life. You know, you live up to 102. That's 102 years worth of lottery tickets. And winning each and every one of those. See, that's how valuable our lives are. Because, you know how different we can have done all this. You know, just imagine how, you know, how many factors there have to be for you to be alive. You know, what's one thing that never sleeps in your body? What's one thing that never sleeps? Your heart. You know, do you think your heart ever thinks, you know what, I've been pumping for, you know, 50 years of my life. You know, today I'm going to take, it's just going to take a rest today. And did your heart ever think that? Think about it. Think about how many hours a day it works. You know, we work 40 hours a week and we think, you know what, I deserve a massive holiday at the end of the year. You know, to rest, to sleep, to you know, do what I like to do. But the heart has no choice. It has to beat. It has to beat. And think about how many things there has to be there for the heart to beat. You know, that's why, you know, if there was a small, you know, ball of fat was to go and block a certain capillary in the heart, you get a stroke. Not stroke, sorry, you get a heart attack. If the same ball was to go to the brain, you'll have a stroke. Just think about it. Think about how fragile your bodies are. How fragile they are. How many things have to be there in perfect synchronization for you to be alive? You know, you got the heart, the lungs, you got, you know, the arteries, the veins, you have the digestive system, you have the enzymes, you have all these beautiful things that are all in place, that are working simultaneously to keep you alive. If one of them stop working, let's take an example. Let's say the pancreas stops making enzymes for some reason. What will happen to you? You're no longer able to digest. no longer being able to digest, meaning it doesn't matter how much you eat, your body's not absorbing. And then you only have a couple of days to survive. Just a couple of days to survive. This is how fragile your bodies are. That's why it's like winning a lottery ticket every single day. One day, the next day, the next day. It's like winning it every single day. And yet we're still winning, aren't we? And yet we think we're still going to win, don't we? I mean, we never think, I might just pass away tomorrow. We don't think that. We have this internally, no matter how much we know that, you know, death is inevitable, that we're going to die someday or another, even though we know that, we still plan for the next week, don't we? You know, you open the fridge and you open your pantries and whatnot, and you say, okay, I have this much amount of rice left that will give me about a week or two more. I mean, think about this. Don't you all have, you know, an idea what you're going to do next week? For example, when I tell you next week we'll be having an ordination ceremony, so there won't be an English sermon, where will you be? I'll be in that ordination ceremony. You know, watching these young men become monks. See, already you think that you're going to survive the next week. Already you have high hopes that you'll be there in the ordination ceremony. What about tomorrow? Tomorrow is Sunday. You have a plan for Sunday, don't you? Now, this is not me going, you know, ranting on about, you know, time and ranting on about, you know, whether you'll be alive tomorrow. No, I'm saying you sincerely have a belief that you'll be there tomorrow. You sincerely have a belief that you'll be here next week, that you'll be here next year, that you'll be alive and breathing every year. That's why death is always a surprise. That's why death is always a surprise. You're always surprised when you hear someone has passed away. Because why? What do you always think? For example, when your dying grandmother, grandfather, right, you know they're going to die, finally passes away, you still have that, they passed away? That small amount of surprise is because you still believe they'll be alive the next day. But yet, your lives are the most valuable things. It's like winning a lottery ticket every single day. How, you know, what's the probability of that? And there's 7-point-something billion people in this world. 7.8 billion people in this world. Think about how lucky everyone is. And yet, there's always these people who think, you know, I'm one of the most unluckiest people alive. You know, I have nothing. Just being alive itself is lucky. Just being alive itself is the most fortunate thing. But yeah, there are some people in this world who think, you know what? You know, what's the purpose? You know, there's no point. I'm so unfortunate. You see, we are very fortunate to be humans. Now, if there's deities, you'll be fortunate to be a deity. But, you know, we're all humans, so we're talking about humans here. We are fortunate to be humans. Or fortunate to be born in a time where, you know, the Buddha's Dhamma is on the rise. You know, if we were to take, you know, go back probably 200 years, 300 years, you and I wouldn't be talking about the Dhamma like this. Go back before the Buddha was even alive. So go back 3,000 years. You and I won't be talking about the Dhamma. You and I will be talking about something completely different. We are all born in the era of a Buddha. A time where the Dhamma is very, very, you know. Sometimes, you know, you look back and you think, you know, how fortunate have I been to be alive? In a time where, you know, the Dhamma is prevalent. Well, the Dhamma makes sense. Being surrounded by teachers who can teach and make it make sense, not just in theory, but practically. We are so fortunate to be alive in the time of you know, the Dhamma. And we are all very fortunate to be in the association of the Mahasangha. People who sacrifice every moment in their time for two things. Actually, scratch that, one thing. They sacrifice their entire time for one thing and one thing only, and that's Nibbana. Now, the question is, who's Nibbana? No, Nibbana. Whether it's this mind or that mind, they sacrifice every single moment for Nibbana. This is why, you know, we're very fortunate. We're very, very fortunate to be humans. Very, very fortunate to be living in a time and place like this. To be surrounded by, you know, the truth. Like finally understanding that we're in a dream and finally trying to wake up. Trying to wake up from a nightmare. We are very fortunate. Now, this is why, you know, if you say that you cannot change, if you say that change is impossible for me, I disagree. I disagree completely. Because humans have the ability, the innate ability, we are born with the ability to change. Because we are all born with the what? With the mind. A mind that is always in effect. And mind that is always in effect. And mind that arises and passes away according to the causes. Causes are nothing else. I mean, who here has a fixed mind? A mind that doesn't change. A mind that just arises and that's it. That's all. It just arises and it's there. Is there anyone here that just can just see? That can just hear? That can just smell? That can just taste. And that's it. No, we are all, you know, our minds have the ability to what? To change. See, for example, right now you are seeing. Can everyone see? Can everyone hear? Can you smell? Taste? Touch? Can you think? If so, what does that mean? That means your mind is constantly arising and passing away. Arising and passing away according to what? According to the causes. According to the views that you hold. Therefore, your mind isn't fixed. Your mind isn't something that's always going to be the same. That's why, you know, your teachers will tell you that, you know, there is always an arahant within you. There's an arahant within you. All you have to do is remove the parts that are unnecessary and the arahant will come within you. Which means what? Which means we all have the innate ability to change. We all have the innate ability to change ourselves, to become better, to become one bit, you know, to change our ways. You know, there are so-called three poisons that we talk about. There are three poisons that we talk about. What are the three poisons? Desire, aversion, delusion. These are the three poisons. Why are they poisons? Why do we call them poisons? We call these three things poisons because they are things that poison our mind. They are things that keep our mind bound. They're the ones that feed ignorance. They're the ones that keep us bound, to keep us attached to our lives. Desire, aversion, delusion. Now, with desire, with aversion, and with delusion, they are all because, of course, they are all because of ignorance. They are all rooted in ignorance and attachment. Without ignorance or attachment, none of these three would be there. None of these three things will be there. Without one of these, without ignorance, none of these three things can be in existence. Because what are they? They are also what? Cause and effect. Only when the causes are there do we have the effect of these three poisons. So without ignorance, these three things will not be there. Without attachment, these three things will not be there. So even these three, they are also things that can change. They are also things that will vary according to their causes. Now, as long as we have ignorance, these three things will be at play. Desire, aversion, delusion will always be at play. This is why in our lives, even though surrounded in this environment, we will always be affected by these three things. Now the question is, how well do you know? How well are you aware of these three poisons? How well do you know and how well are you aware of these three poisons? Because only if you are focused, only when once you're aware, do you realize that you have these three things inside of you. Only if you're focused and only if you're aware, do you know that you have these three things. Because, you know, surrounded in this environment, you can always have this, you always have this idea, you know, I don't get angry. You know, desire, I don't feel desire. Ego, you know, I mean, not ego as in jati ego, but, you know, the ego of pride. Ego, do I feel ego? Surrounded in this environment, we really don't feel these things. Because what happens is the environment has suppressed. So ignorance and attachment are still there, but yet there's nothing that actually gets us to feel these things. That gets us to feel these three poisons. However, you have to be aware. This is why Nibbana is like a mind game. It's a game. You have to be aware of the three things, of these three things. Desire, aversion, delusion. Because these are the symptoms. You know when you have desire, aversion, delusion, that you must have what? Ignorance. If you know you have desire, aversion, delusion, you know you have ignorance. These are the symptoms of the main cause. So this is why we have to be very aware. We have to be very aware of these three things. When they ever enter our mind, whenever they enter our mind, we have to be ready to, first of all, see them. You have to be ready to see them. And that can only happen once you enter the idea of practicing the path. Because once you realize that desire, aversion, delusion are all problems, does your mind start to focus on them? Because if you don't see desire to be a problem, does your mind focus on it? Can your mind focus on it? So you've never thought that eating, you know, me loving chocolate is a problem. Does your mind ever question it and say, you know, you're eating chocolate today. It's a bad thing, isn't it? No, your mind will never question it because your mind has seemed to accept it to be normal. You know, the other day I had a fortune I had to leave at the gates of the monastery for, you know, a small sermon. And it was very funny because I had a traffic light. The traffic light was green. So the car was meant to go. However, a very, I want to say naive, but a very, well, who other than naive? Very naive, not child, but a full-grown adult was crossing the road. Now, the problem isn't with them crossing the road, although it's, you know, it's green light, and so the traffic light means that, you know, the car, we have full permission to go forward. But they were crossing the road. The problem is that they didn't know that they were crossing the road. Why did they not know? Why do you think this middle-aged person was crossing a road but didn't know they were crossing a road? Because in their hands was what? In their hands there was a device. They were tapping away, and we were waiting for this young lady to cross the street, but they were tapping away. She goes mid-road, realizes she's mid-road, turns around and runs back. But the problem is, she still doesn't see it to be a problem. She still doesn't see it to be a problem. Because I can tell you that the next day, she'll be doing the same thing. Only once you see it and realize it to be a problem do you realize, oh, that shouldn't have happened. I mean, think about it. Once you leave these gates, once you leave the gates of the monastery, all you see are people with their heads low, with their hands tapping away on their phones. Or, you know, at least the phone in their hands. Now, when you have something at hand, what does it mean? It means you're ready to use. It means you're ready right now to use it. For example, right? You don't keep your keys in your hands. Car keys, put aside. But, you know, your house keys, you don't keep them in your hands. You keep them in a pocket or in a bag because you only use them to what? Open a door. Open what door? Your home. But if you keep a phone in hand, it means that you're ready to use it. So if you take just, you know, you don't need to go far. Just look outside the gate. And all you see are people who are ready to use, and they don't see it to be a problem. So desire, aversion, delusion are the same thing. If you don't see them to be a problem, if you don't see desire to be a problem, you don't notice it. If you don't see aversion to be a problem, you don't notice it. If you don't see delusion, or if you don't see ego and pride to be a problem, you don't see it. It hides in plain sight. It's right in front of you, but it's hidden to your sight. So the first thing to do, we have to understand that desire, aversion, delusion are a problem. They are something that are there that poisons the mind. They are continuously poisoning the mind. But, you know, aversion is very special. Aversion is something that everyone understands to be, you know, something that is bad. Only in the very, very top level do we see aversion to be bad. Because when we talk about anger, we know that anger is bad. And you knew that anger was bad since the very beginning, right? That's why whenever, you know, you got angry, or whenever you saw someone get angry, you ask them, like, what's wrong? However, aversion in the very little and subtle sense, we don't see. For example, you know, when someone bumps into you accidentally, if you still feel, you know, why did they bump into me? That is also what? Aversion. If you were to go to, say, if you were to go to the Dhamma Hall, and there is no chair, or, you know, the chair that you normally are on, or the road that you're normally on, it's because I know that some people, they book chairs early. They book chairs early. I mean, it's not just something that our devotees do. It's something that I know that our sila shravika shravika sila vasis, as well as our monks, our anagarikas, anagarikas, we all have this ability to book chairs. When we book a chair, sometimes the bookedness of the chair changes. Sometimes the bookedness of the chair, It was funny because once I've seen this happen. I think before Guru Ramdas's sermon, there was a chair that had a bag on it, which technically means it's booked. A person wanted to sit on that chair. So instead of choosing another chair, or doing the worst thing to do is to pick up the book, sorry, the bag, and put it somewhere else, because that's wrong. So this person decides, they booked the chair, right? So they picked up the chair and put the chair somewhere else and replaced the chair. So the chair isn't technically booked. But let's say someone does book a chair, right? You place a bag or something on a chair and you leave. And you come back and you see that someone else has sat on it. Now, because we are all in the monastery, yes, and we all understand, what you give is what you get. And so you don't really react to it and you go, it's okay. I'll look for a different one, it's okay. However, in the back of your mind, you feel, they took my chair. They took my space. Even now when you say it like this, you understand that that's a problem. But when you are in that situation, you don't realize it's a problem. It's hidden in plain sight. Aversion is hidden in plain sight. Only when it's really big do you see it very big. So, it's very, very awkward to see when people, it's very awkward for me at least, when you see two people, get really angry with each other. It feels really different because, living amongst all these great people, you don't see many occasions where people are shouting at each other. So when you hear stories about people shouting at each other, it seems really strange. We see those things to be a problem, but, when someone takes our seat, we don't see that to be a problem. When you turn on a fan, it's not working. I don't know if you've ever experienced this in Dhamma Hall, but if you ever try to turn on a fan on Dhamma Hall, sometimes, there's a very nice diagram with the fans numbered and whatnot. But sometimes you turn on what you think the number is, and you don't check if it's left or right, or you don't check the number, and you turn on a fan and a different fan is on. And you think, you turn back off. You turn the next one. Even that is what? That is aversion. See, desire, aversion, they hide in plain sight. Let's take ego. Ego is one of the greatest things. Because it has an invisibility cloak that it puts on every single time. Something that keeps it hidden until, you really do focus on it. Because it's something that is there all the time. Any scenario can have ego. For example, I'll take one that we can all relate to. And let's take the example of the chair again. When someone takes your chair, if you say something, right, you are saying it because they've taken whose chair? My chair. Why did they take my chair? And you say, excuse me, you've taken my chair. You'll say that not only because you're angry, but also because you feel what? Ego. Because why? Let's say your chair has been taken by Guru Ramdas. Would you ever go and tell him, Guru Ramdas, you've taken my chair? No, you say, the Guru has taken my chair. How meritorious am I? I have given. But let's say, like a small child sat on it. Okay, puta, excuse me, puta. I was sitting there. Again, you acted because of what? You saw the child to be small, you saw Guru Angad to be big, and you're like, oh, I have to respect. Let's say someone does sit on the chair and you say nothing. You say nothing. That can also be due to ego. Why? You know, if I say something, if I say something, they might think, they may think I have ego. They may think I have ego if I say something, therefore I'm not going to say anything. Let them have it. Because ego can slip in every way possible. It is something that is always, something that is always there. You have to be very, this is why the first thing you have to do is be aware. Aware of desire, aversion, delusion, the three poisons. Now, when you are poisoned, what should you look for? When you are poisoned, or let's call them like a venom, right? A poison like a venom. Once you have been, injected with venom, what's the next thing? How do you cure yourself? You have to use anti-venom. Because if you have raga, dvesha, moha, right? Or lobha, dvesha, moha, whatever you call it. If you have raga, dvesha, moha, at this time, you cannot practice the path. When you have either raga, dvesha, moha, these are three times where the path is blocked. You cannot contemplate. You cannot take another step forward. What you need there is an antidote, is an anti-venom. If you're someone that you realize is someone who constantly sees, you feel yourself to have lots of raga. You're very greedy. What is the antidote of greed? What is the opposite of greed? Giving. See, if you're someone who feels that you are someone who's really greedy in some sense, you don't like helping or sharing with other people, you have to, first of all, train yourself. You have to train yourself with what? With dana. Giving. So this is not talking about a single mind here. This is talking about the desire as a whole. So if you're someone who feels that, I'm someone who desires a lot of things, the antidote of desire is what? Dana. Therefore, you have to be able to give. You have to train yourself to have this idea of giving. Now again, this doesn't mean giving things. We're talking about a mindset here. We're talking about a mindset. This is pratipada. This is the practice. Now that's dana, right? Or that's desire. What about if you're someone who gets really angry? What is your antidote? What is your antivenom here? If you're someone who gets really angry, what is your antivenom? Metta. If you're someone who gets angry, your antidote is what? Loving kindness. This is why we have, Sila Pranabhuti Ngiri Hita Anukampiya. What is this? Anti-venom for what? For what? Anger. Because remember, desire, when you have desire, aversion, delusion, you cannot practice. Therefore, if you're able to switch, because this is all habits. When the moment you feel desire, you will habitually do things. Whenever you feel anger, you will habitually do things. What you have to do, you have to change the habit. For example, let's say you're someone who gets really angry very quickly. Have the determination, if I'm someone who gets angry very quickly, have the determination that when you go talk to that person, You start your conversation by saying Thiruvan Saranai. Imagine trying to start a conversation angrily with Thiruvan Saranai. Because normally, you know, when you're angry, your conversations start with what? You? But if you start with Thiruvan Saranai, because that breaks that cycle. That breaks a cycle of aversion. Therefore, you now have an entrance, have a way to enter to the path. Whenever you feel desire, if you're someone who is filled with desire, then the first thing you have to do is find a way to break that cycle. So whenever you think, you know, today, you know, the soya meat looks really good, have the idea that I'm going to give this to someone. Because that breaks the cycle of desire. Now you're able to now contemplate. If you're someone with ego, if you're someone who's filled with ego, who works entirely because of pride, then you have to work on your equanimity. You have to see everyone equally. Treat everyone equally. Whether it's someone who is, you know, greater than you or who is smaller than you, who you think is to be under you, you treat them all the same. Dana, metta, upeksha. Don't they sound very familiar? These are just 3 out of 10. This is why they say you have to fulfill your paramitas. These paramitas, these perfections are the antidotes. These are the antidotes to raga, dvesha, moha. These are the antidotes to your lives. It's only once you start to, you know, fulfill your perfections, are you able to what? Get rid of ignorance and attachment. Don't you see how perfectly those things match? If you're someone who has desire, then dana. If you're someone who constantly, you know, if you're someone who feels that you're always dependent on someone else. If you're someone who, you know, is very, if you feel yourself to be very fickle, meaning that you change. So whenever, you know, you have very, very low self-discipline, then you should practice what? Sila. If you're someone who thinks that, you know, I don't really have much self-discipline, then you should practice what? Sila. You see, these ten perfections, this is your pratipada. This is why your teachers have given them to you, whether you know it or not. Your teachers have made it that these perfections, you practice them unknowingly. For example, having your teachers told you to at least go to the, you know, to spend 5 to 10 minutes and chanting the Buddhaguna, or chanting Aramaitri. What's that for? Or, you know, whenever you're in the Valley Malu, right, when you're trying to practice the path and you feel really tired, and your teachers say, you know, try to stay for 2 hours. What are you practicing there? Or, you know, waking up at 4 in the morning for our monks and Anagarikas and also Anagarikas to attend the Nyaya. 4 in the morning. What is that doing? If you're someone who's lazy, this is the antidote for laziness, virya. If you're someone who you know to be very lazy, whenever you see yourself to be lazy, you have to do the opposite, antidote. Because only once you do the antidote, once you use the antidote, do you cure yourself enough to practice the path. Because if you're lazy, if you're lazy, if you let, you know, if you let yourself to be lazy, what will happen is you are blocking your past nibbana. You see, you have the venom, then you have the anti-venom. If you have, see, all you have to do is, it's a mind game. It is always a mind game. This is why you have to be very aware of your own mind. This is the thing, your teachers can't do this for you. Because your teachers don't know your mind. Your teachers can't read your mind. No one can read your mind except you. If your teachers can't read your mind, then only you can do this. If you ever feel yourself to have a defilement, if you feel a defilement, you have to use your antidote first to open the doors for you to practice the path. That's why when you are angry, can you practice? When, you know, let's say for today, for the almsgiving, you know, they're going to give, I don't know, let's say, it's someone's birthday, and so they're going to give a massive piece of chocolate cake for everyone who comes today. Let's say. Now, let's say you love chocolate cake. Now you're filled with desire. Would you practice? I've hadn't had this chocolate cake in so long. Let me enjoy this chocolate cake. That's the first idea that comes to your mind. Because when you have desire, you don't think about contemplating. So what do? You add what? You do what? Add the antivenom. You like chocolate cake? Let me give part of my chocolate cake away. Now, once you have given, once you have thought at least about giving, you've opened the doors. Now what? You can now contemplate. Why do I feel a desire towards chocolate cake? What is this chocolate cake? Now you've entered. But if you continue to stay in the loop, you'll forget. And that's a moment that you've wasted, that you could have contemplated. Venom, anti-venom. This is why it's a game. It's a mind game. That's why, you know, it's a game that you can play not only in the Vedimadhu. It's not a game that you can only play when you're meditating, contemplating. It's a game that you play throughout your life. Wherever you feel that you are, you know, this over here, I can feel my defilement. That's why the more you practice, the more levels the game has. Just start small. Don't take a big step. Like I said, you know, if you're angry, start with a Theravada Sanghi. It's not big, but it's massive. It's a habit that is not big, but it's massive. It's not a big thing. What you have to do whenever you're angry is to, before talking to the person, to say Theravada Sanghi. But that opens the gate for you to contemplate. It opens the gate for you to contemplate. That's what we need. We need to give ourselves more and more environment. We have to change our environment more and more to make it conducive for Nibbana. That's why, you know, being surrounded by people who are also doing the same thing is very, very useful, very, very virtuous. That's why, you know, this is why you have to be very observant. There will be people around you who will do sort of things that you can take from them. There are people who have done these sort of things. These are your teachers. Ask them. If you ever see someone who, you know who used to be angry that are no longer angry, ask them, how do you do it? Because remember, the Dhamma is just one part of this. The understanding is just one part. The other half is what? the practice. You know, it's like, you know, all you have to do is you have to, you know, listening to sermons and contemplating on the Dhamma is all to do with creating this medicine. But what is the point of medicine if you don't drink it? What is the point of medicine if you don't know how often you have to take it? That's why, you know, your doctor, when they give you medicine, they'll give you time. They say, you know, take one in the morning. They take one at night. They say take one every 6 hours. Dosage and time. You have the medicine, the Dhamma medicine. Now you have to find the dosage and time. The only way you can find that is only you can do that. Is by looking, introspection. Looking at yourself, looking at your own lives. To find it. What is my dosage? Therefore, next time you are angry, now you know, you have the dosage. You know what the time to put it. You put the medicine and it heals. You put on the medicine and it heals. That's all we have to do. That's all we have to do. Whatever you feel in your mind, this thing, you have to be very, very careful. Be very aware. You know, take every moment and think. You know, take a moment and think, you know, what are my defilements here? What is it pulling me back from Nibbana here? Like what I said when I started off, you all have the ability to change. We all have the innate ability to change. All we have to do is find out what is it that we have to change and how can I change it? You have to, if you want to be an arahant, you have to first realize, what do I have that is not arahantish? And remove. What do I have that is not an arahant? And remove. Chip it away. And reveal the arahant within you. This is the thing, this is a game. This is a beautiful game. A game that you play all your life. A game that you can only play, you know, your whole life. If you stop playing, unfortunately the game will continue. Your defilements will increase. That's why, you know, if you decide today that, you know, today I'm going to take a break, I'm not going to contemplate, your defilements don't know that. Your defilements will, you know, will keep on increasing, keep on, you know, growing massive tendrils around you. Because it's not, because, you know, your defilements don't know that you're taking a break today. Your defilements have no idea. Instead, it's just, you know, you have to keep on practicing. Keep on seeing how the mind works. Keep on understanding the way of nature. The more you understand, the more you relieve yourself. So this thing, you need the medicine and you need the dosage. Now, something that we always talk about is this ego, right? Something that we always talk about is ego. And ego is one of the defilements. But ego is something that is... Ego is what creates defilements. Ego is what is the base for defilements. Without ego, these defilements won't be there. Because raga, dvesha, moha, the three poisons, can only grow. They can only grow in the environment of ego. That's why they say lobha, dvesha, moha. But they can also say lobha moha, dvesha moha, and moha moha. Because moha means ego. So if we were to come back to what we were talking about last time as well, So if I asked you, because what I want to do is add a bit more to what we already understand. So if you remember last time we talked about, you know, we have a body and then we have the mind. Something that I want you to always realize is this is what every being has. But whenever we have ignorance and attachment, what else do we have? We have the body, we have the mind, and then we also have what? Defilements. We have the body, we have mind, and we have defilements. Now, what is very nice to think about is that, you know, if we were to take everything, right, and see people as people? No, to see people as a body and mind defilements. If we're able to see that, what you realize is, what is a body? A body, if you look at a body, and if we, you know, whenever you have time, right? Whenever you have time to fight with your defilements, right? Which should be all the time. You know, take a moment and look at, you know, another person, or look at an animal, look at, you know, another so-called being. When you look at a being, look at that body. What is a body? A body is made of what? What is a body made from? Now, you can see a body, and let's say if you take a human, you know, humans have a body, right? Of course they do. And with a body, what else do you have? For that to be a body, what part of the body can you see? You see an organ. The biggest organ of the body, what is that? Skin. You see a skin. You can also see what? You can see movement. What is movement? What is movement? Movement is, you know, your body using some sort of energy to move. So the body, so we take skin, and then you can also say, you know, it's called, you can see probably a skeleton, right? So when someone smiles, you can see part of their skeleton, right? Their teeth. Then you can also see, you know, their eyes, you can see other organs, and you also know that there are other organs at play. So, you know, there's heart, you know, there's lungs and whatnot. But you can break that down further. You can take the body and break it down further, and you say, you know, organs are made out of what? Tissues. Not tissues you blow your nose with, but tissues in the sense of, you know, different cells coming together to do a certain function. Right? So tissues are made from cells. Cells are made from proteins. Proteins are made from what? Atoms. Now, we can say that, you know, we can also go further and say, what are atoms made from and whatnot. But we know that even atoms themselves, right, anything that has a form has some sort of atoms involved. We can say that these atoms can be broken down, and fundamentally, these are all what? Energy. That all this is what? Energy. So the body, because we have two types of energy. One energy is, you know, heat energy, light energy, and those sort of non-formed or energy without that doesn't have a form. And then you have dense energy like atoms, like electrons, protons, neutrons. These are all just energy. So what is a body? A body is energy. So when you see a body move, what are you seeing? You're seeing, you know, this condensed energy. Also, you can also see movement, which is also what? Energy itself. So a human being, or the body of a human being, is what? Made of what? Energy. The mind. The mind is also what? Energy. But what about defilement? So we have, you know, if you say for the body, you have kinetic energy, you have heat energy, right? You've got chemical energy, and then you also have electrons, protons, and neutrons, which are condensed energies. Now we say that there's the mind energy. Do we have defilement energy? Ever heard of ego energy? Ego energy. What is the defilement energy? Is there defilement energy? Because what is ego? What is ego? We all know about defilement process, right? We have what? Can you see the bottom here? No, right? In the defilement process, we have insanity. We have ego. Something that I really want you all to remember is, what is the result of defilement energy? What is the result of the defilement energy? Ego. Ego is created, right? Ego is created, and therefore there's a separate thing that says that's ego. Ego is created right here. At the end of this process, we have what? Ego. Ego is created. And that ego is what we call I or self. Agree? Agree? What's created? What is created? What is ego? Is ego created? Is ego created? The end of this process is ego. Ego is created. Fine. Ego is manifested. What is ego? So when you say manifested, right? This is manifesting, right? This is an object. Agree? The object of ego is manifesting. The object of ego is manifesting. Ego is an object. What is ego? Effect of a collection of causes. But what is ego? Ego is a? It's a feeling, thank you. Ego is a feeling. Nothing is created. There's no object or thing. Because something that we can sometimes fall into the trap of is when we think about ego, we think, because when we talk about ego, we're trying to place it somewhere. You know, we're always trying to relate it to our lives. And so we think I is equal to what? Ego. I and ego are two different things. I is non-existing. And ego is a feeling. I does not exist, but ego is a feeling. Now that's something that you have to continue to realize, because ego isn't something that's created. Ego is not a thing. Ego is a feeling, a sense, a feeling that the mind feels because of what? Because of ignorance and attachment and the process. This process gives rise to a feeling. And that's very, very, you know, very, very important to understand that it's a sense, it's a feeling. Not that something or someone is created. It is just a feeling. The sense of self and I are two different things. What is I? What is I? I is? Ego? I is not ego. Because if I asked you, who are you? you automatically have a feeling of what? Of this fixed, non-changing, this forever being. This forever being. You know, I have been alive for, you know, 30, 40 years, 50 years, and I've lived such a, this sort of life. You know, I remember when I was 5 years old, when my mother said to me, that is I. I is not a feeling. I is not a feeling. I is a fallacy that the mind also feels, but it's a feeling that's created upon ego, upon jati. But in reality, what are we actually feeling? Because remember, ego only arises in one mind. The next mind, where's ego? Ego only arises in a singular mind. When the mind passes, the mind arises, the mind passes. When the mind passes, and when the causes no longer come together for the mind to arise, so it no longer manifests, where does ego go? Where does E go? Where does it go? Does it hide somewhere in the mind or you know, find a way to hide so it can come back again and say, hey, I'm still here? No, it's just a feeling. This feeling disappears. This feeling also goes with the mind. But when the next mind arises and it goes through a defilement process, ego is then created. Ego has the ability to, it's not ego has the ability. Because remember, ego is not something here. Ego is a feeling. This feeling has the ability to connect dots. It has the ability to connect dots and say, oh, ego, 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 I. Then ego, 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 I. Talks about the past and the future when either one of these are not there yet. See, if you understand that it's ego, you can't call a past because ego is only manifested in which moment? Only in this moment. Even ego is manifesting in this moment. But yet, you create. This feeling creates another feeling. Feeling creates a feeling. See how weird this is? A feeling creates another feeling, thinking that it's not ego, it's I. It's not ego, it's I. I am here, I am this, I am that. But remember, this is just a feeling. No one is created. Nothing is there. It's just a feeling. Because there's no ego energy. There's never an ego energy. It's just a feeling. But there is a mind energy. There are, you know, condensed energy and non-condensed energy. Technically, non-condensed energy include mind energy and pure energy. That is what's actually there. But because of ignorance, we create this ego, this idea of something completely different. Oh, it's separate. Because right now, if we got rid of defilement process, who are you? Right now, if we got rid of this defilement process, who are you? Who are you? If defilement process is no longer, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Do you see, we always have a question, we have an answer. Who are you? If the farmer's not there, I am mind and body. No, I am not there. I is a feeling that when defilement is gone, it's not there. Now you can't say I am the mind, I am the body. No, that can't be. Instead, what is it then? Mind happens in a so-called body. Because right now, what is actually happening? I am seeing. I am hearing. Right? That's what's happening, isn't it? No. Seeing is happening and defilement says, I'm doing it. Hearing is happening and defilement says, I'm doing it. Because, you know, even when, because if we take a big step back and we actually look at seeing and hearing, you feel that seeing is something that I'm actually doing. I am seeing, I am hearing. But actually, when you talk about the mind arises with just sight. Sight, when I mean sight, I mean sight mind, seeing mind, which is Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, right? It arises with the sight mind. You are not there. You are not there. So when there's no defilements, who are you? You can't give an answer. You can't give an answer. Because you are what? You are what? A feeling. You know, the other day I was talking with some of our monks and a very nice point came up. The mind is always created at which moment? This moment. Now, if the mind is created in this moment, what happens to the mind in the last moment? What happens to the mind in the last moment? Once the mind arises, the mind passes, what happens to the mind? What happens to the mind? Well, then what should the question be? The answer is right. What should the question be? What happens to the mind? Because the mind is just a part of a process. I mean, it's like taking a massive timeline and saying this part, and saying what happened to this part. This part was just a part of a massive timeline. Your answer is very right. You can't ask what happened to the mind. The mind passes, but the energy goes somewhere. It goes somewhere. Some of the energy is stored. It's stored as what? If there is ignorance, right? And if the defilement process occurs, some of the mind energy is trapped. Sent off to what? Sent to where? Is stored. When I say condensed, I don't mean form. The energy is condensed into vipaka. Vipaka energy, which is so-called stored until the right environment. So what happens to the mind, the previous mind? It disperses. Now, what about the future mind? What will happen to the future mind? The causes will come together and an effect will arise. So dispersion and the coming together of causes or energy. So this is like a continuous process of taking energy, dispersing it. Taking energy, dispersing it. Because of defilements, what happens is that some of this energy is stored and sent back for another one. But in reality, if there was no defilement process, when you realize this is just a feeling, now it's just taking, releasing, taking, or causes come together, energy coming, energy going, energy coming, energy going, until the machine of the mind no longer comes to work. And this is very fun. This is very interesting because, you know, have you ever played these sort of games? Like, what do you call those sort of games? You know, those games that go on forever, like Temple Run, Subway Surfer. Yeah, these sort of games that have an endless map. Your mind is like that. In the sense, the map is only made, or you can only see which moment. That moment. Was there a map to begin with? Now, when I say this, the idea that I don't want to go into your mind is the idea that there's nothing outside. No, there is something outside. Right? Because remember, everything is cause and effect. There has to be some sort of cause to give rise to an effect. It can't be just nothing. Right? You can't make nothing out of nothing. Right? Understand that. You can't make nothing out of nothing. Or you can't make something out of nothing. So meant. You can't make something out of nothing. So there has to be something out here. But this image, or, you know, the map of your life, or, you know, this view that you have, view meaning this, you know, the things that you can see right now, is being made at this moment. Or it's like, you know, going somewhere in the dark. Let's say you're going from place A to place B in the dark, and all you have is a torch. You can only see as much as, you can only see wherever the torch is pointing. You can't see anywhere else. That's the same thing as the mind. The mind can only see what it sees at this moment, can only hear at this moment. When it is seeing, it cannot hear. When it's hearing, it cannot see. But jati or ego puts them together and says, you know, I am doing all of this. I am doing all of this. I am putting all of these things together. And this is who I am. This is who I am. So, who are you? You are a sense, a feeling. A feeling that is there because of this process. But who are you? Just a process. Who are you? Just a process. You know, if you think about it, it's impossible. Impossible. To talk about reality. Talk about reality. Using words. It's impossible. Because now I is just a feeling, right? So if I asked you, who are you? Again, I is just a feeling. Then what is happening? Then you have to ask where. To you, I is just a feeling. It's very, very difficult to talk in reality. It's impossible. Because remember, language is always there for who? For jati, for ego. Language is there for ego. For ego to continue to grow. To continue to do what it's doing. To convey stories. Because that's why, you know, scientists say that language was created for people to convey stories. You know, back then in the caveman era, people will gather around a fire to give stories to one another. Stories is basically what ego does. If you think about it, that's why we like what we like. Because it's a story. Yeah, even with paintings. We love paintings with stories. I remember once I had a friend who was really good at art and wanted to be an artist until another person had told him, your artwork will sell for millions once you pass away. Once you die, your artwork will sell for millions. Because only then do they have a good story. For example, if we took the life of an amazing artist, Vincent van Gogh, when he was alive, he would be giving his, you know, he would be trying to sell his, you know, paintings. Not a single person will buy it. They'll call him crazy, they'll kick him away, and do all of this. And then he fell into a great state of depression, but still drew. And then he took his own life. And now his paintings are stored in massive museums, art museums, not just because of his art, but because of the story behind it. This was the last painting he drew before he took his life. So people will be staring at this drawing, trying to understand his mindset. Because they love what? Stories. Because ego lives in stories. You know, this was the time where he was really happy. And, you know, look at the colors that he's used. Trying to understand, oh, look at all these beautiful colors that he used because he was happy. And then after this moment, look at the colors he used. Why? To create a story. Because ego loves living in what? Stories. So we've got the mind, we've got the body and defilements. Defilements, ego. This is why you cannot talk about anything without talking about ego. Because language is based, it's fundamentally based on ego. Because, look at this, right? I can't say your mind. Because who are you? A sense of self. So I'm going to say mind, body, defilement. And that's all I can say. Look at an animal. I can't say animal because what's an animal? What is an animal? Also what? A sense. Because where is that animal? No, the animal has a body. Because, next time you get to, you know, walk around and you see an animal, just look at it. What is it? You can see a body. If it's moving, and if it's sensing the world, you can give a good guess and say it has a mind. You can't say it for certain it has a mind. You can never certainly say something has a mind. How? How can you do that? Just because something moves, can you say it has a mind? You know, go back, say, 300 years, right? And let's take one of these excavators 300 years back. Right? Right, let's close off the driving seat, right? And we put the excavator, right? Excavator or the JCB 200, 300 years back. People would have believed that was an animal. People would have believed and would have worshipped this massive beast. Only because we know how it works and we've seen drivers get in and out, do we know it's not alive. So we can only guess and say that, you know, there's a mind. And if there is a mind, we can also say if there's ignorance, that they also have a defilement process. How do we check that? Technically, you can't. How do you check if someone has defilements? How do you check? Try scaring them. But if you ever see them have desire, aversion, delusion, you can say that, yes, they have what? Defilements. But still, even desire, aversion, delusion, you cannot be certain and say that they have. For example, let's say you do something wrong. Let's say you break a chair. For some reason, you decide to use something and you've used it wrong. You used the chair wrong and therefore the chair is broken. An Arhat Nuanse comes and starts to shout at you. for the reason that that mind wants to give this mind views. Therefore, it uses shouting. Does an Ayatan Vansa have aversion? But you can think, you know, he was shouting at me, and therefore he must have aversion, therefore defilements. Still, it's an Ayatan Vansa. Someone who's an Arahant doesn't have defilements. So you can't actually judge another person. Again, you can only estimate. You can give a good guess and say, maybe. Maybe they have. Maybe they have. But see the world as it is. So remember, to enter this, you have to use your anti-venom. Then, only then can you see it like this. This is the practice. So again, right? Who are you? Where are you? Right now, as you're looking at me, as you're hearing me, who are you? Just a part of this process. But actually, this is what's really happening. This is just a feeling. It's just a feeling. You know, this is why, you know, ego finds its way to slip into everything. For as long as these are here, this is here. For as long as ignorance and attachment are here, this is always going to be there. Well, yeah, this is why it's, you know, you have to be very aware. You have to be very aware. Be very aware about your own mind. Because only if you're aware do you realize what's actually going on. That ego is just a sense. So who's talking? Who's talking? Who's talking? A mind and body defilements. Who's listening? Mind, body, defilements. Who's going to go for alms today? Mind, body, defilements. Who's going to go home today? Mind, body, defilements. Try to see yourself as well as other people as a mind, body, defilements. Try to see other people to be mind, body, and defilements. It is difficult. Because why? You always see, oh, she did this, he did that. You know, Guru Hondru is going to do a sermon today. But who is Guru Hondru? Question from. What is Guru Hondru? A mind, a body, and defilements. Now, does that mean we can't respect? No, it means we can respect more than we respect before. Why is that? Because now we know that that it's not about a body or because who is Guru Hondru? How do you identify Guru Hondru? How do you identify your teachers? We're using which one? You identify your teachers using the body and body alone. That's why, you know, Guru Hondru is just an image. But when you realize the body and mind defilements, now you're respecting not just the body. You're respecting the mind as well. You're respecting the reduction of defilements. Therefore, it's no more than a person now. Now you're respecting energy. Now you realize it's not just a person. You're respecting energy. The energy of the Dhamma, the energy of the Mahasangha, the energy of the Buddha. Because right now, what's happening? You're all just hearing, seeing, maybe smelling, tasting, touching, I don't know. But where are you in this equation? just a feeling. And then you have to put this into practice. Keep on doing this. Because this is the medicine. This is the medicine. This is part of the medicine. It's part of the medicine. Now, what good is it having just medicine if you don't take it? You have to put it into your lives. Put it into every place you possibly can. Find out its dosage. This is why, you know, discussing the Dhamma is very important. This is why, you know, listening to sermons, discussing, talking with one another about the Dhamma is very important. Because you get the dose, you get the medicine. But no one can make you take the medicine. You can have the most, the most strongest of medicines that they can never find. But there's no point if you don't use it. There's no point if you don't use it. So take them, put into practice, and unleash, get rid of what's not supposed to be there, and reveal the Arahant within you. Okay. So I do have a message for all of you. Next week, we will not be having the sermon because we have the ordination ceremony. As always, you are all invited, right? Each one of you are always invited. Some of you have a choice, some of you don't have a choice. Those of you who don't have a choice, we're very fortunate to be able to witness such amazing people. Because, these young men, they are, technically, this is already there. Again, we are giving a good guess here. This is already there. They already have an ordained mind. All we're doing is changing what? All they're doing is, technically they all have shaven heads. All we're doing is giving them a robe. Because ordination isn't actually about wearing a robe. Technically, you are all ordained. Because what ordains us is the mind. What makes a difference between an ordained and not ordained is the mind, the mindset. That's why it doesn't matter whether you have, a robe and a bald head. What that mind is the mindset you have, whether you have an ordained mindset. Yesterday, there was a quote written on a board, right, given by an icon, right? And it says, ordination is like living like a beggar, but dying like a king. Because their lives will be the same as an anagarika, as another monk, right? Except that they're wearing a robe and a bald head and, they still have responsibilities, they still have to do things, right? But they will live with the bare minimum, right? Begging for alms, living wherever their teacher tells them to live. But if they do their ordination properly, they'll die like a king. Because then defilements are no longer there. No longer need to be worried about, what's going to happen, who's going to do what. Because they have the Arahant within them. So again, you are all invited to the ordination ceremony to bless. I do hope you come and bless each of our... How many Anagarikas? 13? 13 of our Anagarikas, bless them wholeheartedly to have a successful ordained life and die like a king. And also not to forget that we are that we do have our Manvarapingamas. So and on some afternoons we do have a Buddha Puja and another amazing event. Because remember, you know, our entire focus is one thing and one thing alone, is Nibbana. Like I said, and then like I began with, you know, our monks always focus on one thing and one thing itself. Is what? Nibbana. Who's Nibbana? Just Nibbana. Because who's Nibbana? What question is that answering here? This. It's a feeling. But Nibbana is what? Energy here. So, you know, take every moment to do Nibbana. Either Nibbana itself or factors to help Nibbana. Which is what? Merits and helping one another. So that is also you're invited to do all those as well. Do we have any other messages? No? So practice and practice. The more you practice this, the more you're able to get rid of this and reveal the Arahant within you. Okay, let's take a few moments to transfer merits and conclude today's sermon. Let's take a moment to transfer the merits required by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirith, listening Dharma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. So first and foremost, let's remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of Buddhist teachings. And with immense gratitude, let's transfer the merits to the Bhikshu Bhikshunis, Upasakas Upasakas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teaching of the Buddha and passed it down through the generation of a noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, to understand, to comprehend Dhamma. Let's also take one chance of merits to all the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including all Sri Principal Chapters, who have dedicated their lives to no path, the noble path, and committed themselves to betterment of all sentient beings. Let's not forget among them will be the monks and nuns resident in local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come and shine. Let's also take one chance of merits to Gusan Nanse, as well as the monks resident at the monastery, as well as the Anagarikas, Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let's also take one chance of merits and special gratitude to those made great efforts to disseminate the teaching of the Buddha, be that by transliterating sermons, sharing them out to others, inviting others to join them. May the path of merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May by the power of the merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits, express to our devotees, the friends of the monastery who forsake of merits to continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes every one of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, roads, medicines, as well as those who pass their no-hugs and their well wishes. May the power of the merits, if any of them born on the world of plains, may they redeem themselves and born in the blissful plain. May by the power of the merits, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's take a moment to transfer merits to our mothers, fathers, husbands and wives, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews, nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employees, and to all those who've helped us, supported us, assisted in any shape or form. By the power of the merits, may they be healed of any physical mental ailments, may they overcome any obstacles in spiritual progress, may they abstain from unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, brahmins, spirits, demons, primarily Sakadeva, as well as numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the temple of the Sasanam. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to our garden deities who keep watch over us and keep us out of harm's way. May the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom, may they abstain from meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all that have been friends of family to us in this long journey in Sansara. Let's take a moment to transfer merits to
All those who, the armed forces, or was a police force who sacrificed their lives to protect peace and harmony of our nation, may all those lost life in the war with the friend or foe rejoice in the merits acquired today. So let's take a moment to transfer merits to all those who lost their lives in natural calamities such as tsunamis, earthquakes, land time, pandemics, reminding ourselves among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this infinite long journey in Sansara. May the power of the merits, if any of them have been born in the Wolf of Plains, may they redeem themselves and be born in the Whistle Plain. May by the power of the merits, may they abstain from the meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, in its all resolve, may the power and the blessing of all the merits acquired throughout the day. We've been witness the event of many hundreds of thousands of Arhatanvanses, Arhatmahinvanses in this blessed land. And finally, may the power of all the merits acquired throughout the day. You and I, and everyone made this program a success, become an Arhatanvanse or Arhatmahinvanse in this very life, in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga-ginnin-midetn-va Dvesha-ginnin-midetn-va Moha-ginnin-midetn-va Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayin sukita taravetnva Raga ghini niveva Dvesha ghini niveva Moha ghini niveva Nivan sepa labeva Nivan sepa labeva Nivan sepa labeva
Tunrongi, Susyananta Mahogna Belen, Sri Loka Sri Satyoma, Nibbana Paramasukhin, Sukhitaretta.